phantasm remains unintelligible below the level of consciousness. This is Wells talking about this idea about it being sort of akin to the unconscious. It is merely the intellect's ossified incomprehension of a state of life. Because the phantasm is not, in that sense, conscious comprehension, it's not meaning, location, it's not something like that, it's the ossified incomprehension of a state of life. Because of this, the intellect once again represents the most malicious caricature of unreason, that is, a caricature of the life of the impulses. Moreover, the intellect deforms what the phantasm wants to say. But as such, the phantasm cannot have any meaning outside the time of the intellect, outside its dimensions, something monstrous that takes shape only through a delimitation of the non-comprehensible. What for the intellect is a function of continuity from cause to effect is for the phantasm something without any preconditions, a gesture, an action, an event of which the phantasm is the residue, having at the same time the value of a gesture, an action, an event already accomplished or yet to come. Now, there is only one mediator that can say what a phantasm wills. Through its conventional procedures, art essentially reconstitutes in its own figures the conditions that have constituted the phantasm, namely the intensities of the impulses. The simulacrum, in relation to the intellect, is the license that the latter concedes to art, a ludic suspension of the reality principle. So what essentially is being said there is quite simply something like, well, we give to art a power of the truth. We assume or we accept that something in art tells the truth or can tell the truth. Right? Simulacrum in relation to the intellect is the license that the latter concedes to art. So we're giving it license to tell us the truth, or to tell us something about the truth. Now, why it's important and special is because the work of art doesn't say it's true. It doesn't attempt to say this is the truth about the landscape. What it tends to do is it tries to somehow, they might say something like capture or express, or possibly they might use the word represent, but it's that notion of capturing or expressing. Somehow they want to enable what is in the landscape to be in the painting, in the film, in the work of art. And they're doing that by trying to connect these things that he calls intensity. So that will be colours, shapes, forms, tones, atmospheres, all those type of things. So you might have a film that's got an atmosphere of solitary in its setting. Or you might have a painting that just emphasises blocks of colour. So that you see these sort of blocking comes up.
Yes, would like Jackson Pollock, like abstract expressionism, be the pinnacle of that kind of thing?
In a sense, possibly, except obviously what abstract expressionism, I suppose, is trying to sort of connect to is this pure internal of the artist. And so somehow something like an internal life or internal force of the artist, whereas generally speaking, say, and that's what makes it the abstract. It's probably easier usually to just think of expressionism. There's something very specific about what abstract expressionism is trying to bring to the surface, as it were, trying to capture. That's the internality of the artist. But of course, that presupposes that there is some importance to that internality. So there's this peculiar sort of sense then in which there's this relationship between the intellect and the phantasm. There's this sort of peculiar way in which we're trying to say the phantasm but never quite sort of really saying it, the way in which we're trying to resist the unreason of forces, somehow that they're meaningless unless we, find the meaning, produce the meaning in them. But that art has a special relation because it doesn't really talk about meanings, it doesn't really talk about truths, it just simply tries to express the intensity. In doing so, we encounter it somehow giving us the truth. That's specifically located as sort of a prioritised medium. So then he continues. But here we see that under the pretext of modifying human behaviour with regard to the real, The imposter philosopher sets out to experiment the license of the simulacrum in every domain of thought and existence using the methods of science. So the imposter philosopher is the one who doesn't speak the truth, like Nietzsche, the one who creates fictions. They're an imposter because they are no longer assuming a reality and a truth that they can talk about. They are now assuming that in fact what it involves, what philosophy involves, is telling stories, making up things for moral reasons, really, training reasons, selection reasons. And they're going to use the methods of science. So that's ambiguous, I think, between sort of the idea of science as a reason, reasoning procedure, root of philosophy, episteme, doxa, a sort of split between opinion and science or knowledge. So it's using a bit of that, but I think it's also obviously seems to be implying the use of methods of natural science, such as mathematicalized, formalized systems, those type of physiological sciences that we encounter after Darwin, etc., all those type of things. To abolish the principle of so-called reality, it is enough to draw the final consequences of physiology, even if this means denouncing the mystifying monopoly of the intellect, which censorship still keeps the methods of science within the limits of this principle. So what is this principle of so-called reality? What would be the principle What would you think of as the principle of reality, a reality principle? Another way of saying that. Those of you doing Freud, what is the reality principle in Freud? Because obviously this echoes Freud. What does the reality principle in Freud refer to?
Exactly.
For Freud, the reality principle is this thing that derives up from the ego and the superego, and it's precisely the sort of control of your bit of ego or the bit of forces. So it's, the child throws the tantrum because they don't have a reality principle strongly, developed through their ego and the superego. Once they have that, they know that throwing the tantrum isn't really going to get them anything because it's actually going to cause them more pain, etc., etc. So the reality principle derives fundamentally from the pleasure principle mediated through the ego, superego structure. So the pleasure principle, I just want pleasure, that's what the ego goes for. The pleasure principle encounters society. Throwing a tantrum to get what I want causes me pain, not pleasure. So the reality principle moderates your behaviour so that you negotiate, you ingratiate, you sort of persuade. The reality principle here is something similar. Why can't I just say whatever I want about the world? Right. And so if something is true, how am I to know that it's true?
Say it corresponds.
Corresponds with world. And what's out there is real. The assumption that there's something out there to which a thought or expression can correspond is the grand assumption of the reality principle. That assumption is not a fact. It's an assumption. It's a principle that we work with. Now sometimes this might be called in other contexts something like naive realism. There really is a world out there, it's solid, it's the way it seems, and anything that derives a peculiar conclusion such that would deny that is obviously wrong. But the assumption that there's a reality out there is the fundamental core of a reality principle. this next line, if phantasms arise as unintelligible in inverted commas signs, it is not some kind of moral censure that is responsible for their sterile manifestation, in other words, being unintelligible, or appearing unintelligible. They appear unintelligible because they coincide with the reality principle.
So the reality principle, in a sense, contaminates it. Just the word as in, I add something to them, it gives them...
Yeah,
something.
If you think of the phantasm as vague and you can't quite put your tongue on it, and it, you know, it's like, well, even the fact that you think you should be able to make it explicit and clear, that fact that it appears vague assumes you can make it explicit and clear. The fact that you assume you can make it explicit and clear rests on the reality principle that things can be made explicit and clear if we represent reality accurately. And so confusion is encountered precisely because we assume things can be clarified. The fact that we think things can be clarified relies upon some way in which we can clarify them, which if we push further, that's assuming that we clarify it by being accurately representing reality. So at the core of that very notion of confusion or unintelligibility is a sense that things can be intelligible if they are real, if they are true.
I was looking at some modern art, like the first movements of modern art, and there was a fellow called Craig Martin who does an installation called an oak tree. Yeah. Have you ever heard of it?
Yeah.
And that's quite confusing, because you do want to make sense of it, and there's all this explanation of why you can't make sense of it. Like, is it a tree because it's represented? No, it is an oak tree, and that was all it was.
Right, so, do people know this one? It's a glass of water on a shelf, labelled an oak tree. That's it. It's just a glass of water that pours in. And in fact, it was actually asked, wasn't it? I think he put that on the clock, that he was asked, when is it, when is it an oak tree? Before you put the water in, after you put the water in, you know? And he basically says, well, it's an oak tree when I say it's an oak tree. Mm-hmm. So why does that make all of us go, oh, fuck. what is it that we don't like?
It's arbitrary.
It's arbitrary, right, that's exactly the word you need to keep in mind. Is what we find impossible to comprehend is a notion of meaning that is arbitrary. This seems to us to be incomprehensible. It seems totally contradictory. Because if meaning is arbitrary, why can't we just, I make up whatever words I want? And if I can do that, how do we ever get to the point at which we can have a communication? How can we ever have language? To have language is to assume a common, shared way of speaking to each other, which means that in a sense I can't be just arbitrary because I'm limited by the community, by what I can say.
Well, that was one of the questions as well. They said, could you call it he said you can call it whatever you like, but it's still an oak tree. It's just like it defies any kind of comprehension of it.
Well, he's not defying comprehension. What he's doing, I think, what Craig Martin is doing in that situation, he's posing to us this problem of why can't I call something what I want to call it? What is it that refuses to accept that? And it pushes us into the situation of us doing, we can use two arguments against him. A, you're simply wrong and stupid, which we push down and go, well, why are you wrong and stupid? And we'll push down and get to this idea of the reality principle at the bottom. I'm assuming that there's a real thing with real names, that we can get to them and we can share those real names. So water is H2O, and whatever planet we're on, whatever universe we're on, it's always the same for everybody, so you can call it water or low or whatever language you want to use them, but essentially that name belongs to that thing. So things have names. Things are, given real names. This is a reality principle. Now that assumption is essentially what's being challenged here. What Nietzsche is saying, according to Kozlowski, is, well, no, that principle is assumed, but the core dynamic, which we encounter, for example, in Craig Martin, is that the community won't accept that word. The community won't accept that the individual has power to know. The community basically says, as a language user, you do as you're told, or you don't do. That's basically it. You learn to talk the way we tell you to, obviously where that we exists is a little bit difficult, but it basically says we control how you speak. Now, for those people who read 1984, obviously that's a principle that's long been known, and say if you control language, you can control thought. But that principle is essentially all that's underlying Kozotsky here. It's basically saying, well, if language controls thought, language, the limits of language, that what the community will accept controls what it is you can think, you know, that tension needs to actually be accepted as it were, a tension of the idiosyncratic and the gregarious, the social imposing itself on the individual. That's what's sort of at the core of this.
In terms of impulses, how does this work? Because that gregariousness must have been an impulse at some point.
No, he thinks the gregariousness is precisely what he says towards the end of this chapter, is that the impulse to form a community is fundamental. It's absolutely crucial. It's as fundamental as the impulse to form an individual. Okay? Whatever the impulses are that produce this notion of individuality, there is at the same time another set of impulses that produces a community. And you can see this impulse at work, if you like, and the model in which you might want to think about it is something like, you know, a beehive or a swarm. Now, a swarm gathers together, it will coalesce, it will produce. If you ever see, if you've ever seen a bee swarm, it's like a bizarre fucking organism. It's quite, it's not nice. Or an anthill, you know, you've seen an anthill where everything's sort of working together. That impulse to form community is a fundamental impulse that's sort of taken here as the impulse of gregariousness. It's part of the sort of moves that occur in this collection of forces. And that community can be taken on various levels. Ants, bees, human societies, the community of organisms that produce cellular structures. So it goes all the way down. So from the very sort of basic combination of, you know, cells, once they've formed their initial nucleus and wall, from the combination of cells into multicellular organisms, they can argue it's the same impulse that underlies the formations of society, the formations of swarms. And that impulse is contrary to and aims to destroy and stamp out the impulse of the cell itself, the individual. It aims to essentially sort of integrate that fully. The cell can exist so long as it accepts that it's just a cog in a machine. The minute it thinks it's not a cog in a machine, well, you know, if it's helpful, it's useful to the organism, we'll let it go. The minute it sort of encounters a struggle with the organism, the collective, the community, then it will be put down again. So the tension here is that somehow Nietzsche thinks that the human is a peculiar organism which builds its organism from individual cells. And there's a dialectic, there's a tension between how much he wants to encourage the cells to be healthy and strong, idiosyncratic, and how much he wants to do that because it has its own reason for that, which is so that the overall body is stronger. So, you know, you eat well, you take exercise, you do all these things to increase, essentially, the strength of your cells in your body. You don't do it to, you know, you don't really care about your kidney cells. You don't care about your, you know, liver cells, your blood cells. You don't really have any interest in, if, you know, if you cut your finger and it drops, you're not going to cry every time a bit of your blood drops out. You don't really care about that. It's just always a bit of blood, you know, and then I'm wiping it, I'll throw it away. And that's essentially the same tension that Nietzsche thinks exists in society. You are essentially a blood cell, which if you happen to, you know, wander around trying to be a little bit different, will just be expunged. You know, the little T cells will come in and kill you. And if you think about that in terms of cancer, for example, a cancer cell is nothing other than a cell that doesn't want to die. That's all a cancer cell is. So a cancer cell is a cell that switches off its self-destruct mechanism. All cells have a self-destruct mechanism. Cancer cells switch it off. So a cancer cell is an immortal cell. And your body destroys the immortal cells. So that cell, which has reached the stage of being capable of continuing to exist in almost a parasitic way, that cell is destroyed by the body in order for the body to survive. And the same thing that you think occurs in society. If you are, you know, so idiosyncratic, so powerfully individual, that you begin to produce a sort of immortality, you know, you're a Plato, you're a Socrates, whatever, the There's a point at which society will tolerate it and encourage it because it wants this strength, but it will also destroy it. You know, it's a limit point where it thinks it's going to confront the orders, it's going to confront society. And that's precisely what Socrates encounters. Now, Socrates accepts this. Socrates' response is, of course, if the society tells me that I should kill myself according to the law, then I kill myself. That's what I do. That's what a good philosopher, knowing the truth, does. Nietzsche is saying that there's something else that needs to possibly occur.
Why does Nietzsche favour that side? Why does he favour the singular over the gregarious? Under what grounds does he say we should go in that direction as opposed to this one? And what reason has he got for that side not becoming gregarious itself, but with a different flavour, a backdoor gregariousness?
Well, I don't know. I don't think he necessarily has... what do people think? Other people got opinions. I don't think he's got a very, very powerful argument. I think he's got an argument that seems to rely upon something like a notion of strength in variety, you know, that there'll be... You can only reach the strongest point in a limited situation, a limited set of cases. And to reach that strongest point, you know, the individual has a sort of tendency to... For the individual to reach its strongest, most dynamic, most powerful point would immediately confront society with something that was hostile to it. In that sense, I think that's his core argument that anyone really seems to make.
So pushing a limit, sort of thing. Just.
Yes, I don't think he favours one or the other, strictly speaking. I think what he favours is trying to bring out this tension that exists between the individual and society, between the idiosyncratic and the gregarious, and trying to work on this idea that in a sense they're both codependent, but fundamentally the impulse to a very, very powerful idiosyncratic individuality fundamentally thinks will be destructive to a community. It will be antagonistic to it, so it will be repressed.
I mean, we do that. We kill those that go too far, in that sense, throughout history. We've killed Jesus, killed Socrates, poisoned Osho. Those that go to the point where they completely antagonize everything that's been laid down by the reality principle, or a big...
Yes, but you're taking certain characters, yeah. I mean, yeah, we also destroy serial killers.
Yeah, that...
you've got to object to this.
Yeah, there is no objection, is it? It's the same thing.
A serial killer, in that sense, is just someone that's a pure individual.
Yeah.
They have no relationship, a sociopath, pure individual, no relationship to society, no care about the society's rules. I mean, how is, in that sense, it positive for us to encourage that level of individuality? So we will talk about levels, we'll talk about limits, we'll sort of say be an individual within limits. Don't be an individual, but be an individual within limits. The limits are what I'm willing to tolerate as a society.
Doesn't Deleuze talk about retaining some of the organism? Or keeping like one foot in dominant reality so that you can use it when it comes to...
Yes, it does, and I think that sort of relies upon this idea of negotiation, but the problem with that is that who has the power in those situations? You decide to be an individual, so let's just take a simple do something different. Everything that you see someone do in front of you, do something different to it. Wear something different, you know, to the point of wearing no clothes. Don't pay for your food when you go into a shop or a cafe, you know, just refuse to do what society does. And you won't even last a day. You'd be arrested pretty soon, I would imagine, you know. I mean, generally speaking, now you can take slightly more devious ways, you know, learn Klingon. Do various other things, but of course most of those other things are just going to be putting you into smaller communities, not individuals.
But surely like under like the concept of the eternal return, where everything has happened before and will happen again, like individuality, there's nothing really as true in individuality because it's already happened before, so I'm honest.
Right, I mean, in a sense, yes, that's true. So what do we, I mean, let's go back to that. So okay, we're facing this situation between this sort of society, the reality principle, organising itself and defending itself as a sort of big collection organism, the individual as a sort of single dynamic. I mean, how is it you think that that's going to work, I suppose? How do you think that dynamic is going to work in that situation? You know, if everything's already happened for, what do you do faced with that tension, but there's also this thought, this return, what do you do in that situation? How is it how do you respond? Because that's the question that's posed in the internal return. It's not, is it true or is it not? But it's how do you respond in that situation? How do you respond to this thought? If it's already happened before, well then so what? You know, that seems to be what you're...
Well, not really, but true individuality, original, but if you can't do anything truly original, then can you actually do anything truly individual?
Right, okay. So that would so we're going to define individuality as being original? Everyone to dispute this? Connection so far?
Well, if it's an individuality, because the term turns out all different ways you can go, and it's all different possibilities, even because when it goes back on itself and it's doing exactly the same thing, it's still individuality, because individuality can just exist constantly, correct? But it's constantly going around. There's not really an end to individuality, is there?
I don't know. I don't know, to be honest, the answer to that. But no, presumably presumably in a sense it's one of the options, so there's no end in that sense, even if it sort of disappears at this particular moment in time or not. But we're looking at this idea of originality, so...
Well, it's more of an idea of singularity, I think.
Okay. Well, stick with originality at the moment, because we think of originality as doing something that no one else has done before. Yeah? Now, let's just shift a bit. The root of originality is origin. So originality, at its root, is being the origin of something. So the reason it's interesting that no one else has done it before is because I am the origin of this thing that no one else has done before. What's interesting about it is that I originate it. That's what my originality is interesting for. Now what that is essentially doing is it's giving me a power. Okay? So the individual as that which is original or originates is given a power. So what is that power? The power that is located here is this power to act, or will. So being capable of acting, or being capable of willing, is being capable, as it were, becoming a sort of centre point, an origin point. And that, even though I might write or say something that's actually been said before, or someone can say, well, it looks like that, it's analogous to this, it's not really original, nothing's really original. That would sort of miss the point. The idea is that the core of this idea of originality, what you would call originality, for Nietzsche, Kozlowski, is this notion of act, a real act, or a real will, a will that's in that sense. And we move back to this peculiarity, obviously using a reality principle, but one that we can say exists, is a better way perhaps of putting it. And in that sense, the response to the eternal return is to see that as a problem. Try and work out how, in this situation in which every possibility has occurred and will occur, can you be an origin point? Can you be an act? Because that's not what you are, but it's what you're given the option to be. It's what the phantasm of this idiosyncratic produces. In trying to sort of, what the phantasm of the idiosyncratic, the peculiar, the anomaly, the different, what that phantasm produces is this sort of thought that I think. When I think it, I produce a simulacrum. The simulacrum is of the individual, the subject, the I, the origin. That which is capable of acting, that which is capable of willing, that which is capable of being responsible. But I don't have it, I am presented with it as a problem. So the eternal return presents that with me as both a possibility, of obviously it's a possibility that this single acting thing, the idiosyncratic, can be part of the eternal turn. But it doesn't say that I am it, it presents me with the possibility that I somehow have to then become, have to affirm that. The possibility is in me. I am that possibility. But I am not an individual yet, just because I say I. Does that make sense? This is the tension at the heart of this. It's not denying subjectivity, it's not denying the self, it's not denying the I. It's basically saying something like, in the eternal return, in this encounter with these sort of, ontologies of forces, what we encounter in this combination between the eternal return and the ontology of forces is this possibility of this thing that I think I am. So the possibility that I can think, the possibility that I can be an object, the possibility that I can actually be an actor, someone that makes a difference, as Deleuze calls it. A difference that makes a difference. Rather than just another fucking one.
Is that the only time you can say that? You, I, self, individual.
Well, I mean, what other options do we have? Philosophically, what options do we have in terms of our, in terms of subjectivity? Well, we have solipsism. So what is solipsism as an option? That's, there is nothing but. So there's only one thing, and it's me. Okay, so that's one option. What other options do we have for a sense of, for the concepts of subjectivity?
Freedom.
Such as, let's try and just sort of get a couple of ideas. Such as, like Sartre. So Sartre, what's Sartre's concept of subjectivity?
Freedom, based on?
Yeah, based on the fact that I'm a power of negation. Yeah. So somehow I'm this power of negation, and there's the general positive working life thing that does its stuff and grows and dies. And, you know, then there's me, this peculiar power, you and all of us, this peculiar power of negation that can say, I am not that. So there's a dualism of Sartre and negation. What's the Cartesian dualism?
A mind over a body.
But what do we usually call it?
The thinking thing.
Yeah, but it's usually a little prefix word that goes before the dualism. Substance dualism. So you've got, there's only one thing, the I, solipsism, maybe Barclay, if you like, I don't know. You've got someone like Sartre, powers, the power of negation, that's the core of the subjectivity, the power of, you know, the natural world, that's immanence. You've got substance dualism. There are actually two different types of things, such as Descartes. So you've got a range of different sort of, you know, at least three there we've got. You could probably come up with at least two or three others quite quickly. So assuming that the one we're faced with here is not this, not one of those three that we're just looking at, what sort of sense of subjectivity do we have here? Is it power? Is it solipsistic? Is it substance? Okay, let's rule out, let's look at substance. Is the two substances posed here? Would you say there are two substances posed in this book? So you're not going to get it wrong, just suggest what you think at the moment.
No.
I don't think there are. You'd have to probably find some strange passage to suggest there are. We can probably rule that out pretty quickly. Is there just one thing?
No.
Okay, why is it not just one thing?
Because it's one thing split into two sort of thing. It's two impulses coming together. Not exactly different. The same impulse in two directions, if you like, going in two directions.
Okay, so there's at least two. Because, I mean, what words are we going to use to sort of suggest these two?
The gregarious and the
same. Right, the gregarious and the idiosyncratic, and at least two different dynamics, tendencies, whatever. So it looks like we're closer to something like the Sartrean notion of powers. There are different powers that exist. Okay, so we've got something like that now, yeah? So our subjectivity is, let's say, some sort of power. So what sort of power? I mean, Sartre is the power to say no, I am not, negate. So it's quite simple. It's a description pretty quick, isn't it? So what's this one?
to act, give me.
I think it's connected to that, yeah. It looks like it's connected to that. I mean, it looks like that's going to be somehow crucial to it.
Would it be to give meaning in terms of these two particular impulses? Meaning in a gregarious sense or meaning in a singular sense? If that makes any sense whatsoever. Because we can see how we can ground meaning in a gregarious sense. If I say something about me and you understand it, that's gregarious. But if I say something about me and you can't understand it, then nobody in the world can. Then we'd have a pure singularity. But me, if I can understand it.
Well, the common gregarious language is what's called what? It's the language we generally speak in this book.
Science.
Particularly.
Talking about the code of everyday science.
Code of everyday science. So that's what we can sort of think of as he's talking about sort of the common everyday language of gregarious. So there's this tension here between this idea of the code of everyday science and science, generally speaking. So the idiosyncratic is going to be using signs, perhaps, that are part of the code of everyday science. Now, there's a step up from signs to meaning. They're distinguished between the two. For example, birds give signs out when they sit, when they open their plumage. You know, there's a sign on the side of the road telling you where to go. There are signs of the weather, you know, in the air when you're looking around. So signs are a radically different type of thing to meanings, yes? Hmm. Okay, so now the core is this, it's a code of everyday signs. He's not assuming they've got meaning. They're just a code of everyday science. So they could be the same way that a bunch of primates have a certain relationship of showing their asses to each other. It's matrices. It's a code of everyday science, in that sense, isn't it? It's just a set of standard functions of sort of cohered and habits, as it were, of a group to communicate with each other. Impulses, sexual desire, hunger, food, shelter, cold, fear.
Which implies gregariousness in that sense, otherwise it's what?
Right, but they communicate. Because these impulses are satisfied by others in the group. The crucial thing to note there is that he talks in terms of science, and it's not until he begins to talk about this peculiar encounter with the eternal return that the issue of meaning arises. Okay, that something can be meaningful is right at the core of this. Now, if it's not grounded on the reality principle, it's grounded on something else. And it's to do with this idea of there are all these various possibilities, amongst which meaningfulness is one. If impulses can produce absolutely anything in terms of the infinite sort of structure of the eternal return, it's just a thought experiment. There is an infinite time and an infinite set of impulses, and they can produce an infinite set of combinations. Well, 99.9999% of those can be just, mechanical. But only once does it have to happen that it's not mechanical for meaning to arrive. So everything else can be, in that sense, meaningless once something occurs and it has a meaning, whatever that is. Now, we still don't know what that is. But the meaningless is only defined after this one thing occurs. Prior to meaning arriving, nothing's meaningless. Mm. I mean, do animals have meaningless interactions with each other? Do they have meaningless sex? Mm-hmm. It's a category error, sure. It's a category mistake to talk about meaningless sex amongst your animals. Yeah, your pet's had a meaningless sex again. I mean, what a strange notion is that? It's a peculiar idea. My cat's outside having meaningless sex. No, it's just having sex, it's just doing what a cat does. We don't even call it sex out. We're talking about sort of mating. We have a whole sort of set of ways in which we reconceptualize it outside of the way in which we conceptualize mating. So it only has to happen once, this combination of forces that produces meaning, for then everything else to be retroactively seen as meaningless. But prior to this one thing occurring, it's not, it's just natural in inverted commas. And so what we're looking at is, what is it that occurs when something is given meaning? When meaning arrives. Well, fundamentally, is it what's occurring? What does he say here? I mean, it's even very simply put, to fix a goal, to give a meaning. He takes them to be the same. To give a meaning, for meaning to arrive, is something to perceive that it has a purpose, a goal, a telos. For that concept, as it were, or phantasm, to arrive. That there's some purpose, meaning, goal, aim, direction, sense to my life. Now, why would that be, as it were, powerful?
Because of its destructive force. Imagine what it can do to the things that are already meaningful. It sends a new trajectory.
Let's look more closely. I mean, when you talk about the phantasms, we noticed one thing was missing from the phantasm, that definition of phantasm. The phantasm was an image of what had been or what could have been, but it was not an image of what is. Okay? So, what could have been, what's a different way of describing that?
A possibility.
Okay, a possibility, but let's take the idea that in 1941 we could describe a history in which a different situation occurred. What is that different situation? A different future. You can't have a meaning in the present. If you only live in the present, there is no such thing as meaning. Meaning needs a sense of the future. Direction or telos is not here and now. It's precisely something to which I organise the here and now to go towards. So meaning opens up this notion of futurity. Future. To fix a goal, to have something to aim towards, to go towards. It's this encounter, in a sense, in the eternal return with time that's at the core of this relationship to meaning. We organise it in one way. We organise it in terms of meaning, in terms of relationship to the future that we organise as it having meaning because I'm moving towards it. Utopias, better lives, you know, what am I going to do tomorrow? What sort of job am I going to have? You know, how is it going to be with my girlfriend next week, you know, if I don't go and get something decent at Valentine's Day on Saturday? You know, it's like, you know, Valentine's Day itself is organising a sort of future for us and all these sort of things. You know, these things are organised as a sort of leading towards, taking us out of the present and putting us towards the future.
That's true. What about if you, when you actually arrive there? Isn't that a moment when you're...
You never arrive.
What if I wanted something?
You never arrive in the future, do you?
No, that's true. But what if I wanted something in the future and I gave it, I applied a meaning, I said this is meaningful to get my degree, etc. I get it, and then does it has meaning in the present? Yeah. I don't know what I'm talking about.
Okay. So your purpose, let's say here in now at college, is to get a degree. That's the sort of organising the meaning of your life. But when you come out next, whatever it is, September, and you come and, you know, get your fucking piece of paper from the silly fucking ceremony, wearing your funny hats and all that sort of stuff, what meaning does it have then?
Isn't it that's the old meaning? It's like filled up with it. It's like
the climax.
Yes. Well, no, it's just immediately replaced with another me. It's
replaced with something else and
it becomes a me.
Even if it's like taking an express.
It's always becoming, never being.
Yes.
Yeah, I
can't fulfill meaning. Meaning in this sense is permanently the sense of sort of what we're aiming towards. It can, in a sense, be fulfilled by reaching certain things, but being fulfilled is turned into a means.
Yeah.
Turned into just some tool.
I do agree, but I'm just saying, there are philosophical opinions contrary to that.
Oh, God.
Where there are, like, I mean, I think Plato even, is that?
Well, they're going to use notions, I mean, most philosophical notions, this is the other thing, we'll finish with this today, is that most philosophical notions are going to organise, essentially they're going to work on the basis of something like a reality principle. If they don't use a naive reality principle, then it's just a simple world with stuff that we can name one-to-one correspondence. I mean, that's naive realism. But if it doesn't organise a naive realism, what it will do is it will organise a sort of a set of ideal reals. So the true, the good, the beautiful. You know, so the point of knowledge is to find the, you know, the truth in terms of the good life to lead, the beautiful thing to appreciate, the right thing to do. So it's to educate ourselves in terms of those types of meanings, those types of principles. So those become the reality, that there is a truth, that there is a good, that there is a beautiful, that there is a right. That we assume to be real, we assume these things to be real, and we organise our work to try and find and get close to, and then we can finally get there. What Nietzsche and Kozowski are trying to do, and this is the point you're trying to constantly try and remember, is they're trying to work out why those ideas arrived in the first place. They must have a purpose outside of themselves. There must be a function to the idea of truth. There must be a function to the idea of beauty. There must be a function to the idea of good. And that is what they're interested in. And in that sense, they're interested in the truth behind truth. The truth behind the good, the truth behind the right, but it's a very different notion of truth now. It's a sort of, in this sense, it is experimentalist. Well, they're talking experimentalist, they're sort of basically saying, well, if we use this model, how does this affect us? And what crucial to any notion of experimentation is not assuming that there is something like a real true, a real beauty, a real world. You have to assume, for the sake of argument, that there is no real. There's just a series of functions that are produced by impulses. So even the idea of the real, in that sense, is a function produced by impulses. So you're trying to look at what, these are things that are produced, but they only sustain themselves, they only maintain their sort of presence with us because they have some role, they do something. So that's what we're looking to see what is going on. We're looking to see what it is these things do. How do they affect interaction between the gregarious and the idiosyncratic, between the cell and the organism, if you like? Do they benefit one or do they benefit the other? Which is it they work for? Which is it that sort of maintains them? Is the relation to truth maintained by the community or maintained by the idiosyncratic individual?
So if we look at this, say we take this and we apply it as a critique to in Kantian terms, would we say that every single category that Kant proposed is actually not necessary, is a creativity of an impulse, and therefore can be displaced
in
certain time?
But the fact that it takes itself as necessary
thus
is also
the truth behind the truth that we're...
Well, it's also worth, this idea that something is absolutely the core of the subject is this idea that it takes itself to be necessary. And you have to think, well, why? What would I lose if I didn't take myself to be necessary? What power would I remove from myself? What would I be unable to do? What am I able to do with that notion? You don't think this has to be true or false. You don't have to even think about whether it's true or false if you're necessarily, a subject. You just think, well, as a subject, I think, therefore I am. And the whole sort of cartoon thing. What is it that I lose if I give that up? What is it that I gain if I use it? And obviously, we can talk in terms of knowledge, we can talk in terms of pleasure, or you could use a whole variety of different ways in which you can talk about those things. Okay, well, you're meant to have finished reading the last chapters by next week. I think we're probably going to be spending another 2 weeks on this text. I would like to try and get to the learners, but I'm inclined to give you essay questions just on the Kozowski and spend a little bit longer on the Kozowski at the moment.
Why?
Because I think we can extract a couple of bits from the learners and you can probably use them in your exams. You can write down questions about those. Also, I think we've still got some work to do in trying to just get you to finish reading the text.